Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and a very warm welcome to the Ind AS series on Insolvency and Bankruptcy Code, Innovative Acquisition Structures. As a reminder, all participant lines will be in the listen-only mode. There will be an opportunity for you to ask questions after the presentation concludes. Should you need assistance during the conference call, please signal an operator by pressing star then zero on your touchtone phone. Please note that this conference is being recorded. I now hand the conference over to Mr. Vyapak Desai. Thank you, and over to you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you, Ali, and thanks all the participants to join us on this part 5 of our IBC series. And considering the kind of participation we are getting, we are sure that this will further continue. And I think even the external environment, the regulations, and the jurisprudence is also in a way helping us to continue this series in many more parts to come. So after doing the first 4 parts on April 10, May 2, May 24, and June 14, today we would continue as part 5 of our IBC series. With 3 of my colleagues, we have been joined today by Rajesh Sinhan, who heads our international tax practice. He's heavily involved in several of our corporate transactions and recently advising many dealers and interested parties in the IBC process. We also have Simon, who has been part of our earlier IBC series as well, who heads our private equity and M&A practice, and also a senior member, Abhinav Harlalka, who is involved in several corporate transactions, both in the PE and M&A space. So with that introduction, let me kickstart this webinar. As we have seen in the last more than 2.5 years, while we'll be celebrating 2 years of IBC soon, in the next few months to come, I think there has been a significant progress in the way to deal with the tax restructuring in India. I think we have seen more than 800 cases admitted as part of this process, more than 120 being resolved or liquidated. We have seen 4 major transactions or 4 major companies where the RP or the resolution plans have been approved. As everyone knows, in terms of Bhushan Steel, Electro Steel, Monetis Park, Intech Auto, and a few others are at a very late stage. Therefore, we thought that it may be an opportunity to discuss the real structures that have been adopted in most of these plans, and also look at this as to how the regulatory environment and the participants to the economic activities in India are reacting to this IBC. We have definitely seen that this has brought a significant change the way the creditors and debtors are behaving, going forward. Particularly, we have seen a lot of structures and a lot of actions are being taken at a stage where people are avoiding to even go to the stage of IBC because of the serious consequence of an admission under IBC process, which is the current management and the promoters losing the control on the company. So I think the first question that we want to deal with today and I'll ask Abhinav to deal with it briefly and then go to Simon, is how can we know the implications of IBC? Obviously, the current set of promoters and corporates and even banks in terms of the program are looking at the situations to deal with the restructuring even before the IBC. So maybe Abhinav, can you elaborate? Why would one look at that provision as to whether you want to really restructure even before the IBC kicks in? in terms of what are the advantages of doing this before and after, or what are the disadvantages, particularly from a corporate or a regulatory environment. So,
I think if you look at how RBI has been looking at it over the last 5 years now, almost since the JLF came in, they had a number of various options like JLF, HDR, S4A. In February 2018, they overhauled the entire system and they brought in a single circular which governs the entire restructuring of stress asset framework. And the intent of RBI seems to be that each asset needs to be restructured or else everything ends up at the IBC. Which essentially means that, you know, if you don't end up restructuring before the IBC, gone are those days where you could just keep delaying it and ultimately you will be dragged to the IBC for a restructuring. Now that is where it becomes important for, you know, the promoters, the lenders, the various stakeholders to decide and take a call on what would be relevant or what would be beneficial for this rather in restructuring under the insolvency and bankruptcy code under the CIRP, or would it be beneficial for them to do a restructuring prior to a CIRP process being initiated by a lender or by themselves voluntarily. So I think there are multiple points which needs to be considered, which could be, you know, beneficial under the IBC or under the IBC as the case may be. One of the most important things is the number of parties are dealing with and how potentially is the discussion. It's like, you know, what we usually say in arbitration versus a court proceeding. An arbitration is more of a confidential discussion between two parties. That's what a pre-IBC restructuring is akin to, where it's, you know, at times that one-time settlement between the lenders and the debtor sitting on the table together, as opposed to a process under the IBC, where it is a much longer process where you have, you know, operational creditors, you have financial creditors who come in and you have to deal with all of them in a particular manner which is provided under the code. So as opposed to that, that's always a beneficial aspect for the company, for the debtor, as well as lenders at times to have their entire discussion prior to the IBC where they can agree to a restructuring or reconstruction proposal and, you know, move on rather than going under the IBC. Another very important consideration that has come up after the amendment is the 29A restriction, where, you know, it says that any promoter who has been a willful defaulter cannot continue to be in the company as, you know, the promoter after the resolution plan is approved. So that's become an important consideration and that is actually driving a lot of promoters for, you know, pre-IBC discussions and pre-IBC restructuring, because that is one way to ensure that they do not lose control of the company. I think these two are important considerations. I will come back to the other points that I think are relevant. I'm going to ask Rajesh or Simon if you have any points.
Sure. I think, you know, you touched upon the points on timeline. I think, in my view, it works both ways. PIBC, obviously, you are flexible in terms of the process and timeline, but then it is always never-ending in a sense that there is no deadline. While obviously IBC gives you a certainty as to within 180 to 270 days, at least something has to be done, otherwise you are, you know, through liquidation under the process. So I understand that point. But other than the timeline point, Simon, what about the aspects of shareholder approvals? What other aspects under the different codes or regulatory and securities law which may or may not apply in different situations, and whether you should be preempting situations and taking it before the IBC kicks in, or you are possibly better off after the IBC kicks in because you get certain advantages under the law?
Sure. So Vyapak, I think that's a good question. Now, pre-IBC and post-IBC is a matter of, you know, thinking. One is, you know, looking at the law, because the law has given various ways through the IBC mechanism. But commercially, you have to sort of weigh the pros and cons, even to look at it commercially pre-IBC. Now, I think Abhinav did talk about the promoter, which is the most important, most important sort of aspect, because a promoter that has been declared a willful defaulter and even committed person tomorrow through the IBC lose the ability to remain in control if you go through the IBC process. But I think, like you said, shareholder approvals today, every process, whether it's change of control or whether it's issuance of shares, does result or require a shareholder to approve it, including, sale of assets. Now, the IBC resolution plan doesn't really require shareholder approval. The minute it is accepted by financial creditors, it becomes binding on the company, and shareholders don't need to approve this. But if you are implementing or trying to implement a structure today that requires for the company to act a shareholder approval, given that all the other schemes of the Reserve Bank of India have been withdrawn, you will, pre-IBC stage, perhaps require a shareholder approval. And we perhaps will deal with how, some structures have been done innovatively, whether it's in the industrial situation, which may not have been able to be done pre-IBC. I think another sort of point to be reckoned is dealing with, professionals appointed by a tribunal vis-a-vis dealing with their own professionals. Now, you can only deal with the registered, entities that have been now registered with the NCLT as resolution professionals. So therefore, you are limited, perhaps, in your outreach of finding professionals to deal with. Whilst in a pre-IBC situation, you have the ability to deal with professionals that you deal with, so it's a wider sort of set of people. Also, like we discussed, in terms of the law, the Securities and Exchange Board of India has granted a lot of exemptions to entities acquiring or converting the securities through the IBC process. Even the delisting regulations now do not apply if you acquire through the it is as a result of a resolution that has been adopted through the IBC process. There are a lot of benefits under SEBI laws, for instance, if you go through the IBC process. This may not all be possible if you do a scheme of URI as a resolution without getting funded. So there are pros and cons with respect to both. But I think above all, there is an element of reputation concern, right? If you go through the IBC process, this entire process, it's a little bit more public than perhaps a resolution with financial creditors in a closed door room, where you have the ability to agree differences. So therefore, I think lots of commercial considerations that are important to be looked at when pre-IBC.
So let me, Simon, throw a point which is possibly not a legal issue as part of pre-IBC and post-IBC or a regulatory point. But as we have seen in one of the Kolkata NCLT data, where one of the bigger issues which the NCLT was dealing with is even the expenses, the kind of fees that the RBs are charging, the valuers are charging, the forensic experts are charging, and even lawyers are charging as part of this NCLT process. It was a matter of concern as to whether this was approved, not approved, what will come out of the expense of the COC, or whether it will come as part of the liquidation value, and what is reasonable, what is not reasonable. Have you come across clients or situations where even this going forward may become one of the considerations? And do you think that this is a real issue, or this is something which has unnecessarily gone into a situation which is not possibly so requiring that much of
attention? I think, with lawyers, I hope not, because we hope that lawyers' fees can be paid by clients irrespective of anything. But on a more serious note, I think cost expenses and the credibility of the people that are appointed as resolutions is very much questioned sometimes by people that are doing having a base. Now, I think what we also didn't discuss was the level of perhaps diligence, right, and acquirer could do in a pre-IBC versus a post-IBC. In a post-IBC situation, you are time-bound, you are running a public auction, you are running a process, and we've seen that litigation that consistently arises in this regard. So you are always time-bound and things are extremely public. So the amount of time an acquirer can actually spend, even though, you know, it may be limited. In a pre-IBC situation, especially, you know, dealing with acquirers that are looking for key assets, and assets that are can be sort of restructured privately, you have more time to spend diligence, you have more private conversations that can be had, and it's with perhaps advisors that you can get to the table as opposed to the latter. So the credibility, the sort of you know, there are only sort of only so many individuals or so many professionals today that can actually deal with high value transactions, right? In terms of bandwidth, in terms of know-how. There's limited professionals that can deal with that. And the number of companies that have gone and been in the IBC process of 800, it's difficult to achieve the same level of perhaps knowledge and credibility with the quality. Therefore, you know, the cost benefit analysis is something to work out in favor of a pre-IBC, especially where the asset is smaller and you want to spend more time on the asset as opposed to a post-IBC.
Sure. So turning to a little more focus on possibly the biggest driver for most of the transactions, which is the tax considerations. So Rajesh, anything which has come out as part of IBC, which makes the transaction under the IBC even more efficient, and therefore people are looking at IBC as one good way of acquiring assets. Because something which you could not have done outside IBC, you could now do it because it becomes commercially viable because of the tax leeway, particularly the issues related to debt and carry forward losses.
Sure. So Vyapak, at least to my mind, I can think of three possible considerations, right, as to why people would probably tend towards an IBC process more than a pre-IBC process, at least looking at it from a tax perspective. One is that obviously the benefits which are embedded, especially with some of the recent amendments, as far as the tax laws are concerned. Particularly, as you rightly pointed out, one is with respect to minimum alternate tax, and the second is with respect to carry forward of losses. When it comes to minimum alternate tax, today the provisions of law effectively provide for a situation that if you book profits, if the tax that you're paying in total is less than 18.5% of the book profits, then you have to pay as much as minimum tax. And this is a complete separate computation mechanism which is provided, whereby you first try and ascertain what the book profits of the company are for your financial, and then you make certain upward or downward adjustments to that. The challenge has been there is that especially when you have a situation where there is, let's say, a one-time settlement or any haircuts taken as far as any loans are concerned, that can have a potential impact as far as the profit and loss of the company is concerned, which means that you are effectively in a situation where there is a high balance in the profit and loss account, even though the company by itself is actually a loss-making company. But because of the notional, because of the write-offs that are being made, there is a notional increase as far as the profit and loss is concerned, and the impact as far as the minimum alternate tax. What the IBC mechanism really allows for, and there are major amendments to the income tax act in this budget, is to say that in respect of any accumulated losses and an absorbed depreciation which is available in the to that extent, that will go towards reducing your book profits. The law in other situations is that it is the lesser of the unabsorbed depreciation or the accumulated losses which are to be considered as a reduction from the P&L for the purposes of becoming MAT. But once you go under the IBC process, it is the actual cumulative total of the accumulated losses and unabsorbed depreciation, which is computed in respect of reducing your profits because of any potential write-offs and write-backs. And therefore, to that extent, you are ensuring that there is no artificial tax leakage which comes in once you go into an IBC process, as compared to a pre-IBC process where you don't really have this particular exemption. The second aspect is in respect of change in control. Because today, if there is a unlisted company, right, or rather to be more precise, a company in which the public are not substantially interested, if there is a change in shareholding of more than 50%, then you lose the benefit of the carry forward losses that you have in your accounts. What the leeway which they have provided is to say that if you have been admitted under the IBC process, and this is all part of a resolution plan, in that situation, you still get the benefit of the accumulated losses or the carry forward losses that you have in your books. Especially in a distressed situation, both of these are huge benefits that you end up getting. This sort of tends to push you towards going down the IBC path, purely because you probably end up getting a better tax sheet as compared to a non-IBC. I think the third aspect which can make a determination is from the perspective that in a pre-IBC process, while you are settling with the bank or you are doing a one-time settlement, it is all well and good to come into a conclusion around it. But especially in companies which have significant defaults as far as tax liabilities are concerned, or in cases, for example, where there are potential attachment orders which are already there against assets because the company has not been able to make the payment because they don't have the cash flows for it. In those kind of situations, it becomes a bit problematic because your pre-IBC process does not really allow for any settlement with the tax authorities. It's not a case that you can try and go to the tax authorities and say, I'll pay you 60 cents on a dollar. And therefore, write off all my past tax issues which are there. That's not something that you can really do. Whereas in an IBC process, if the resolution plan also allows for in respect of the tax issues and all, or certain tax liabilities which are there, you can actually create a resolution around it. So that also sort of, it obviously depends on how much what kind of tax issues the company already has and it is facing, to sort of make a determination as to whether it's probably better to go into an IBC process or to sort of try and deal with it as a PIC.
Sure. So that is just continuing the discussion on the tax issues. So in the current plans, right, for the structuring, debt restructuring that we have seen, do you think any of this would have affected the way some of these plans were, proposed, or there were no significant difference in which the plans were proposed, but this would be something little more to look forward as part of the process as we see the things going on, or is it something which is coming out of the past experience?
So I think a couple of things. In fact, if you see most of the way in which the ones which have gotten through, there has always been some discussion around the tax liabilities in terms of even the tax authorities getting only cents on the dollar potentially. And we've even had situations where in a IBC situation where assets were sold by the company and that was subject to attachment of the assets by the income tax authorities. Where the High Court have come in clearly and said, listen, once the company goes into IBC, the tax authorities can no longer claim their dues. And they can no longer continue to impose on the attachment order. And to that extent, yes, you're free to have actually sold the assets at that point in time. So, yes, we are actually seeing some of these benefits percolating through in some of the way the matters are going through.
in terms of the resolution plans. And as we go forward and see more of these coming out, you will definitely see a nice big broad section on how the tax liability is being dealt with. Because what we need to keep in mind is one of the first things which tends to happen in most of these companies, because there is obviously a cash flow crunch, and the first set of payments which they probably end up not making are the statutory dues. So that, and especially when it comes to tax, you have the basic tax, interest, penalties, multiple year proceedings. So there is always a big chunk of matters which are there, and IBC sort of helps in sort of cleansing that at one shot.
So taking this forward, and in terms of after discussing the matters in more generic, right, as to what is good and what is bad in terms of pre-IBC, post-IBC, the threat of IBC itself is creating more structures. Can I go a little further down and maybe Rajesh or Simon, if one of you want to look at the current plans, which were obviously very straightforward and plain vanilla, where most of the plans have been based on simple equity infusions and then retiring the debt based on the headline aggregate or the COC. Are you seeing or are you involved in any advisory where different structures are being used, particularly for the acquisition of debts, refinancing it as part of the IBC or just before the IBC, and looking at things which may not be a simple, straightforward, IBC acquisitions, where you just put in money and then retire the debt. Any ideas we want to maybe Rajesh or Simon wants to take it first and then maybe the other can respond.
So let's just go back to, you know, the entire sort of realm of structuring today and whether things really differ for a company using the debt through the IBC process and or not. And I would just like to divide this into, you know, the acquisition stage and the post acquisition stage. Now, whenever you think about a structure, you have to give due consideration to the acquisition stage, especially in an IPC, because the entire intent is to see how to put money in the most lucrative manner and to retire existing liabilities. But very important for the acquirer is to look at the post acquisition strategy, because at the end of the day, the intent to infuse and the intent to acquire is to, of course, make this a profitable venture, and therefore extraction of profits. And how do you sort of view this company going forward is extremely important. While first in terms of the acquisition strategy, you have a large amount of benefits, the latter, the going ahead strategy, doesn't really have any benefits going forward. Therefore, you need to sort of ensure that the instruments you use and the way you structure your deal contemplates or captures both. Now, the cardinal sort of role of structuring is to ensure is to of course, see the kind of company you're investing in, and especially in the respect to the companies that have recently gone bankrupt with the IPC process, have been really asset-heavy companies, and therefore, and you would need to definitely do a good sort of analysis of debt versus equity to see how money can be extracted going forward. So therefore, the cardinal principle of structuring to look at a good sort of debt equity structure continues to apply whether it's an IBC or a market IBC company. But in terms of what we've seen in the in terms of the resolution plans that have right now, you know, been scrutinized or being accepted by us, I think a lot of them are dealing with listed companies, right? And therefore, the main concern or criteria for any acquirer coming in is how do you really acquire control of this entity and ensure that the control today is doesn't really, you don't need to have a perhaps a public offer or exit opportunity in the later years and you maintain the control within yourself. So in terms of understanding how to structure the vanilla deals that we've seen, or they do include the inclusion of capital. But I think one sort of structure that is a little bit out of the extraordinary in the electrosteel RV renovation plan, which had a combination of infusion, it had a delisting of Amir, and it also had a capital production scheme, all this one, so as to ensure that the control remained within the Elabra group. And I think that was quite sort of a use of all committed exemptions with us under the Companies Act, no shareholder approval required for capital reduction, under the takeover board, no open offer required for acquisition of control of the listed company, and under the DDC regulation, no pricing requirements required to be complied with under the DDC regulation, so long as it's approved by the resolution plan. So I think it was a sort of a bend. Now, we may argue that this was not in favor of the investors really, because you also never seen you had equity shares being reduced in terms of face value, and sort of consolidated thereafter, and shareholders were sort of given at the end of the day perhaps a little less than face value in terms of consideration for the capital reduction scheme and the delisting thereafter. But by having said that, it was a clever way of using all the exemptions provided under the SEBI, as well as the Companies Act, to achieve 100% control. Now, in terms of how these looked at, one is how do you repay the lender? Is it going to be through OTS, wherein the company is going to repay the lender? Is it going to be a situation where you do convert debt into equity and then you have the capital reduction scheme, and by giving the lenders cash back? The third would be to see how you sort of infuse cash into the company. Is it going to be through a optionally convertible instrument? Is it going to be through a debt instrument or an RPF? These are the sort of instruments you deal with. And everything, of course, has something or the other to do with tax and there's a very sort of structure video.
Sure. So, maybe Rajesh, taking the team on the left, and particularly looking at the offshore structures, right, versus domestic investors, do you think that the IBC is now throwing upon opportunities where one is benefited over the other, or with the offshore structures are not getting some of the opportunities which IBC is throwing upon as an opportunity? And will that kind of a provision lead to a better deal for the creditors? Otherwise, outside IBC, obviously they were not getting the right lead. So do you think this is really addressing the problem? Otherwise, to look at the liquidation value, bring in the equity based on the liquidation value, based on it, just doing an OTS, doing a 70% haircut, if this possibly the promoter would have done otherwise as well, if he was given that opportunity before the IBC. So are we really better off? Are we seeing interest of investors coming back because of the new opportunity? And more particularly, is there any difference for offshore versus domestic in this context?
Sure. So I think if you just step back and think about what can foreign investors do versus how do domestic investors today, because of the way the exchange control regulations work, domestic investors probably have a lot more flexibility in terms of structuring any of their acquisitions in respect of even companies which are in the IBC. If you look at pretty much most of the public examples, all of them involve setting up of an SPV undertaking the acquisition, SPV probably putting in a mix of nominal equity, some portion of RPS or CRPS sort of situation, and some subject to the OTS coming in, and possibly a capital reduction to take out the existing shares, a capital reduction in some form or manner. That's really probably the more common. investors that we are seeing are domestically, in terms of domestic investors. When we are talking about offshore investors who are coming in, offshore investors have certain limitations. They cannot do, they are limited in terms of, let's say, investing by way of OCRPS or investing by way of CCPS and even investment by way of debt. So, payment in equity obviously gives them a lot of, nothing that would come from putting in a lot more equity into the company. Obviously, we still have to talk about considerations from a Section 56 perspective in respect of issuance of shares at less or more of the fair market value. But 56 is still probably also in terms of a primary issuance, because you are actually coming in at what is probably a process-driven fair market value position. So doing a primary is easy. Doing a secondary is still a lot more difficult, which is why you don't see too many secondaries happening in respect of the stakes, the promoters, for example, being sampled. You won't find too many of those examples. Because one, obviously, from the fact that no money is going into the company, and the second, from the perspective that you are running into issues as to whether a transfer is happening more than fair market value or less than fair market value. Because if it's less than fair market value, and fair market value for tax purposes in Section 56 is a book value driven concept along with multiple other adjustments, which especially in an IGC process, you are never sure as to whether you're actually paying more than the 56 valuation mechanism. So which is why you don't see too much of that happening. But what it ends up doing is that even a foreign investor, be it a domestic, be it a strategic or be it a financial investor, you can actually find examples of them actually setting up holding companies or SPVs in India, which then undertake acquisition, rather than them doing it directly. Purely because having the Indian company as the top book gives a bit more flexibility around in terms of how to sort of structure it. But today, otherwise, you end up, while foreign investors, a lot of them are actually interested in assets. One of the biggest challenges for them is how do I then start, what is my best possible structure as far as investment is concerned. Which is why even today, when we see some of the distressed debt market, a lot of them are using the ARC structures where they're subscribing to SRs and the asset reconstruction companies are picking up debt on the market. But today, looking at it very practically, domestic investors always have a lot more flexibility in terms of the ideal investment structures in respect of even companies charged to IBC. Foreign investors till now either use the India HoldCo structure. People have contemplated use of AIF, though I haven't seen any of those actually go through for doing the acquisition till now. And we are obviously seeing their structure structures also.
Sure. So bringing in Abhinav in this discussion, particularly there was a huge UN drag about Section 59E. It is restricting the kind of leaders who can come in, and it is too wide. It doesn't allow flexibility even for financial investors and certain kind of entities, particularly which are possibly regulated by SEBI or NBFC and things like that. Now when those exemptions are already put in place, where at least 29A is relaxed to some extent, it's not really. But the way we have seen IDC transactions, they are very limited to mostly strategic investors doing plain vanilla transactions. Do you see that now with some flexibility available under 29A, you will possibly see some of the financial players jumping in, either at the back end or at the front end? And what trend do you see in terms of the structure for the entity, which would be now good enough in terms of, you know, what IBC wants to do, which is bring in many more players as part of this process, rather than restrict it to certain people who would be interested in working out the IBC?
So I think you're right, Vyabha. The fact that the entire
bulk of the acquirers or potential acquirers that we've seen till now have been strategic players. That I think probably will start changing now with the exemption that you rightly mentioned have been provided to, you know, financial institutions, ARCs, who convert the debt into equity. That will also provide a lot of the financial institutions the flexibility or the encouragement to acquire the debt and then go for conversion, because they have that possibility, they have that exemption provided to them. This coupled with other changes that have been coming on the periphery, you know, for example, ARCs could not have more than 26% shares in a company, which changed earlier this year, late last year, to allow them to go up to whatever amount they have to, because of the fact that, you know, they realize that ARCs were at disadvantage to the other various financial players. So when you look at the entire gamut, I think it's becoming a situation where the financial players, be it, you know, an alternate investment fund which is set up by a foreign investor or a domestic company which has a bulk of limited partners or investors who are financial investors, can acquire. And this is also going back to Rajesh's point, where foreign investors do not have the flexibility that a domestic investor does. An Indian AIF, which is Indian owned and controlled, may provide a foreign investor flexibility also. And we've seen financial investors using this structure quite often to invest into Indian assets, and I don't think it's going to be any different under the IBC. The ARC route, which has been opened up, you always have the NBFC route. There are concentration norms that one has to be mindful of. But, you know, I think over time, we will see certain exemptions and relaxation in those provisions also. And it will get to a situation where financial investors will probably have a lot more options and flexibility than a strategic player. When you look at the entire regulatory framework coupled with the same exemption that Simon was mentioning.
Sure. So, Rajesh, also, the way the most of the transactions that we discussed have happened, where equity is infused and debt is retired, do you think this is efficient? Do you think this is effective? Do you think there can be any other way in terms of conversion first and buying all the equity outside rather than new issuance of shares, particularly from a tech perspective? And is that any different from a domestic versus foreign investor? Are there any tax provisions at the moment, or you would wish that those provisions were made so that this kind of a transaction or a structure would make this process even more attractive, which will possibly attract more participation? Because I still feel that the participation from a wider group of investors is still very low when it comes to IBC structures.
Sure. So, if you step back and think about it, what are the differences? I think, to my mind, there are four or five different forms, and there are various competitions and combinations. But essentially, primary infusion of equity, which is currently probably the most favored form. The second is the secondary transfer of equity. Secondary transfer can happen either because the funds have converted a part of their loan into equity or transfer of some of the other shareholder shares. The third option is probably having the assets being picked up. And the fourth one is what we call a merger, demerger sort of situation. And when you sort of step back today, what you find predominantly is the first one, which is really the primary infusion. Because today that probably has, at least at this point in time, the most optimum return. Because purely, because the moment you start getting into secondaries, then the strategic valuation comes into place. Because if you're buying it at less than fair market value, which is effectively just the book value. In that case, you're taxed on the spread between your acquisition price and the adjusted book value. And especially in a lot of these asset-heavy companies, immediately actually find it at below book value. So you would want to avoid sort of doing secondary transfers. The third one is asset sales. Asset sales are something that you never, not really as a whole undertaking by itself, because obviously buying the shares of the company, I still get the cash shield, both in respect of MAT and in respect of the carry forward of losses, which I don't really get if I do it as a asset purchase.
And also, to add to that, CRC has to ensure the business will carry on as an going concern. If there's one asset sale, may never be on the cards itself unless you're doing a small hive up just to, you know, to ensure that the business continues. So it will be limited in that sense.
That's right. And the fourth one is the amalgamation or a merger, demerger sort of combination, where again you are still restricted because the carry forward of loss benefit under Section 79 is what is being given the benefit under the IBC process, not the one relating to amalgamation and demergers, which is a separate provision under 70A. So to that extent, you are still limited by the restrictions which are sort of set out in terms of amalgamation, which is there. And also, I think, more importantly, right, today, even if I wanted to do an amalgamation or a demerger, I essentially wanted to amalgamate the company along with my existing operating asset, which at least, considering that once you are in the IBC process, any buyer who is coming in has probably had a limited amount of diligence or a limited amount of visibility into whether are there any other hidden liabilities or issues which they have not really looked at, because they have not, unlike a pre-IBC where they have probably done a proper diligence, so they don't have the ability to do that. So why would no acquirer would want to on day one try and do it as a process whereby they are amalgamating on day one with the operating asset? What you will probably find is the SPV structure which has been used to acquire the company through various instruments. The SPV is then merging with the operating company or the public company at a later point in time to collapse the structures. That's probably the more common method that you will end up seeing, but not really a situation where as part of the resolution plan you're doing an amalgamation. You will find it in very little.
The only sort of change I would add there, Rajesh, is one benefit of the of going to the IBC is, you know, going to require shareholder consent, right? And as we know, the NCRC is quite sort of overburdened, and therefore a merger and amalgamation thereafter may be something that, you know, may not really work. For instance, I mean, if you have a subsidiary that is a subsidiary worth sort of merging into, like in the Money Espace and Energy Limited policy, right, where you had a subsidiary merging into the company, you may also want to do that as part of the RC, especially if you have, if within the group there is a subsidiary that is worth considering. So that is something, you know, maybe that could actually work.
Sure. So let me throw all other set of issues related to structure, right? And we have discussed companies which are just PIBC in the sense where you are anticipating an issue which is possibly getting into an IBC situation, and versus structuring at the time that you are already into an IBC. Are there any restrictions or opportunities where you can use different kinds of entities or different kinds of instruments which possibly are not allowed in this sort of a situation? So just to clarify, are there good structuring options in terms of the types of instruments which are easily doable when it comes to a pre-IBC situation versus IBC or vice versa? Or use of entities in that sense. Is that something that you would advise a client that, okay, you are at a situation where you are just about the IBC, you better do this structure because that structure then may not be possible once you get into IBC or the type of instrument, so that even if post that you go into IBC, you're still insulated to the kind of IBC consequences that the company would.
Your question is basically investors that are, you know, that remain in the company post the IBC. I think, I don't think the company that has been amended or will give you a sort of opportunity to have influence to get your valuation, or potential value, plainly, you know, after the IBC process or as a result of the IBC process. you are an investor in a company going through an IBC, you will be subject to IBC norms, and you have with your paper as a financial advisor, depending on if you have an instrument or not. Now, I think what becomes important is, you know, what sort of shareholder or security holder are you? Are you a debenture holder? Are you a RCS, a person shareholder? Are you an equity shareholder? What sort of instruments do you hold? And what sort of instruments perhaps can you gather from others to create a bigger sort of share? Now, with respect to preference shares, if you are an RPF holder, for instance, or a team of preference shares, the question always arises as to whether you are a financial creditor at that time. Now, very often, instruments are structured in such a manner as to give you, especially if you are a domestic investor, you may have the ability to convert an obligation or perhaps a right into an obligation, thereby giving you perhaps the color of a debtor as opposed to a color of a shareholder or a shareholder. And therefore, in that situation, maybe you can change your color from a shareholder to a debtor, which gives you a higher sort of standing. Let's give an example of a CCD, for instance. A convertible debenture, perhaps you may not be a financial creditor in the true sense, because your instrument is actually convertible into shares, and therefore you may not meet the definition of debt as defined under the IBC. But for instance, if your instrument term changed from CCD to OTD as a result of an insolvency or bankruptcy, you may get a different standing in terms of things. Now, you know, unfortunately, through all the law changes, one law that continues to remain the same is the DEMA. And therefore, foreign investors may not really be able to benefit or, you know, achieve innovation through this technology. Domestic guys perhaps could use. Now, in terms of, you know, what can you do to be able to achieve the benefits of the IDPO2? One is to see whether, you know, especially from a lender perspective, interim financing seems to be something that is extremely key. Now, the benefit of interim financing is that you stand at the top priority in terms of the liquidation of the company, right? So anyone coming in has to pay you in full for your terms of interim financing. Therefore, when the company needs it, if you have a vehicle that can lend, that becomes a UNC. Now, foreign acquirers, as we know, since a lot of have changed, are limited in their ability to lend because of the debt rules available to them under the exchange control laws. Therefore, if you have perhaps an AIF structure in place, or you have the ability to lend through an NDFC, that may be something that could really work. Could work for you.
Sure. So I think a lot obviously needs to be done in terms of creating or innovating some of the structures as part of the IBC. But before I possibly ask that question to each of you as to what is that one or two things that you would still want to change to make this even more efficient, maybe last question to ask Rajesh in terms of what Simon was discussing as to the different instruments being used or different entities being used. Does that change anything in terms of the 56 issue or the 79 issue in terms of is the flexibility of the instruments that a domestic investor can use gives the investor an edge over a foreign investor? Or it doesn't matter so long as the underlying value subjects you to the tax incident as in case of your equity.
So I think the way to look at it is to see whether what is the outcome that the investor is looking at. Is the investor looking at the asset because he or she perceives that it has good cash flow, which they want to extract over a period of time? Or sort of look at it as an equity play, which means essentially saying that yes, I think I'm going to get a good equity upside over a period of time.
you obviously want to ensure that either you have put in as much debt as possible or possibly have OCRPS or RPS as possible. Whereas if it is more of an equity play that you're looking at, you're to a certain extent indifferent in terms of the instrument that you're sort of coming in with. So even as a foreign investor, even if I'm subject to the various restrictions, I have to put in necessarily equity or a CCD and all. I'm less concerned about it because ultimately what I'm really looking for is an equity play. But obviously, if the cash flows of the company are really exhaustive, then probably a domestic investor may be slightly better off because he'll be looking at putting in a lot more debt, some debt, whichever way it is, it may be in it, or a OCRPS, RPS. I think that, to my mind, I think that's the way to sort of look at it. See, how are you actually, what is your, as an investor, what is your thought process? If it is for domestic strategic investor who already has existing operation, may use it. SPV right now to acquire it, but it's the intent that you merge all the operations together because you're going to get a much larger play which you can potentially use for the purposes of getting the equity upside. So it depends on what is the intent with which investors is coming in, more than anything else. I think interim financing is a good example, right? Today, because of the way everything works, it's effectively the domestic guys who can actually provide interim financing. So even if the foreign guys are actually very interested in it, they're sort of restricted in terms of what they can do and what they cannot do. So it depends on where in the pie that you want to put, what part of the pie you want to get.
So before we throw upon this, webinar or questions from the audience, I think maybe we can do one last round of questions with all three panelists. And this time, if each one of them can give one or two maximum priority in terms of what they want to see going forward. Let's go. Which are the regulations, laws, provisions, methodology to change or amend to make sure that some of the hurdles or roadblocks that we are seeing today are also met with. So maybe we can start with Abhinav now and then.
So, I'm going to answer the question by not saying this is a roadblock or a hurdle as such, but it becomes an important consideration in these larger transactions from a commercial perspective. A lot of the transactions in a different state, there are exemptions, stamp duties, there are lower stamp duty rates. However, the IPC and the larger accounts that we are seeing are extremely asset heavy, especially immovable property. And the high rates of stamp duty does become a very important cost consideration for the, participants or the potential bidders. So I think one important thing that would probably be on my wish list would be some sort of exemption or, a substantial reduction in the stamp duty applicable for cases under, IBC resolution plans. That would be, I think, for me, one important point that I would probably look for.
Sure. Rajesh? What more provisions for the next budget?
So I think there are three areas, right? One is around 56, one is around 50. Both of these relate to the seller's the valuation as far as the buyer is concerned or the valuation as far as the seller is concerned. If you've gone under the IBC process, there is an auction process, there is a bid process which is submitted. That should be the end of the case. I mean, don't go beyond that to try and determine or setting what is the fair market value, what is the value going on. I think that's one big aspect. But I think the second aspect where they can try and do some degree of tinkering around is in respect of remission and for forgiveness of debt. While we've spoken about the changes to the MAT provisions, but you also have other provisions in the Income Tax Act which potentially treat that certain kinds of forgiveness of debt, especially if it's not on the capital account, as being more in the nature of current income for the borrower. So I think that's something that can be re-looked at, especially in a situation where that's gone into what you would call as a process, a whole IPC and auction process. I think that's the second one. I think the third last aspect I would talk about is to sort of ensure that their circumstances, because there are multiple provisions in the Income Tax Act which can potentially provide for past liability on directors in respect of company, liquidation and all of that. Sort of
see what needs to be aligned with so that you don't end up in a situation where an orderly winding down process under IBC scenario is suddenly sort of interfered with because, well, somebody goes in of the other party, which was not really contemplated.
Sure. So, Simon, this act definitely is the most amended act in less possible time. I don't think any other law has been amended so many times in less than 2 years. Any more amendments that you expect or you would wish?
So should I start with 29A or we can leave that for a different conversation? So I think the 29A issue needs to be defined a little bit more. I know we spent a lot of time on other webinars and what 29, whether there should be one or not, but I think our viewers have been that the acquirers that need the help of promoters should be able to rely on them, and they shouldn't really be bound by a condition of law which says that we cannot really help. Of course, there can be ways to ensure that it's not indirectly benefiting the promoter's investment, but the acquirer that an independent acquirer that is not related that needs the assistance of a promoter shouldn't really be deprived of it merely because of the technicality in the law. I think that's one change that we should see. Second, I mean, I would say is that, you know, some laws today have not prescribed leeway for acquirers to be at the level playing field in terms of acquiring assets or infusing capital into a debt-related company. Therefore, whether it's the ECB regulation or, you know, just infusing capital into a company, whether it's the OCRPR route or any sort of debt instrument, convertible or hybrid instrument, first priority should be given to change the law in favor of companies and in favor of debt. And I think, lastly, it would be good to see how we can achieve a functionality of liabilities, really. You know, the one concern that has always risen with respect to acquirers is, you know, what is not disclosed to you, what is something that could come up later that would have preceded the entire process of acquiring this asset. So, on the one hand, you know, you have to ensure that, you know, regular commercial process, regular contracts, people are not deprived of their rights to specifically enforce using the, you know, minimum likely to be now approved under the Supervision Act. But we also need to give some sort of finality to what could be a liability, you know, to a possible acquirer. So I think those would be my wishes.
Thanks a lot. Thanks, and maybe now we can open up the floor for the questions from the participants, and then of course look at some of the questions which have already emerged as part of this discussion, subject to any other questions from the participants.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, we will now begin the question and answer session. Anyone who wishes to ask a question, press star and one on your touchtone phone. If you wish to remove yourself from the question queue, you may press star and two. Participants are requested to use handsets while asking a question. Ladies and gentlemen, we will wait for a moment while the question queue assembles. A reminder to the participants, anyone who wishes to ask a question may press star and one. So there are no questions in queue.
Sure. So maybe we can close the conference.
Just any closing comments from your end?
So, of course, I think this was obviously a very different point in terms of what we want to make this webinar series to the next level. So what are we now expecting in terms of the actual structures? And we would be dealing with this a little more in detail going forward, particularly when we are expecting many more accounts to come in. I think RBI has already prescribed and given a roadmap for certain slabs for the NPAs and the debts, which are now possibly turning into NPAs. We are also seeing a lot of
operational creditors taking the companies to IDC, and this will possibly will also force upon a lot of restructuring companies to IDC. We are seeing tax provisions and other laws being already amended to see more participation as part of the restructuring. So I think next time we'll deal with some of the new you know, avenues which are being created and opportunities that we are being created as part of this process. With that, thank you each of the panel members, and thanks for the participants to join this part 5 of IBC, and we look forward to get you onto our next session as well. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, on behalf of Nishit Desai Associates, that concludes this conference call for today. Thank you for joining us, and you may now disconnect your lines.